And we're kind of live right away. We're doing it.
It's happening.
Right now.
Right now.
You hear yourself.
I do.
You sound great on the radio.
Thank you very much.
This is great.
Thank you very much.
Right? Everyone's attractive and awesome on the radio.
Yeah, it's easy.
So who are you and what do you do?
My name is Jairus. I work for the Mozilla Foundation. I work on internet health. I try and make the internet better.
The internet healthy?
Yeah.
How does one keep the internet healthy?
Well, it turns out it's quite difficult. So I work on the Internet Health Report, which is a publication that we put out earlier this year to try and measure the health of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
But from a human level, there's a lot of reports out there that look at like IPv6 uptake or cryptography. We're trying to look at the effect it has on people.
Okay.
So looking at these different issues, including security. So what does increased security mean for people? But also what does increased trolling and harassment mean for people? What does the absence of certain languages on the internet mean for people who speak those languages and who without a font for those languages can't use the internet? So we're trying to look at it from a larger kind of environmental perspective instead of individual data points. We're trying to look at the system as a whole.
So from a metric, so it's not just like security, it's how people are interacting with each other.
Absolutely.
It's how they're getting access to it and what they can and can't access.
Yeah.
And
who's invited, who's included. There's a digital divide, but the digital divide changes depending on where you are. In some places, the divide is really strong along gender lines. In some places, it's rural versus urban. In some places, it'll be linguistic minorities. So who's invited, who's there, and what does web literacy look like for people to really use the internet in a way that's effective? One of the things that we looked at in our report is we did a study in Kenya where we did we created a digital skills observatory where we took a number of people who had never used a smartphone before and gave them a smartphone, and it was a research project with a control group and everything where we tried to determine what are the skills people need in order to be able to use the internet effectively in a way that makes their lives better, basically. And it turns out there are 53 different skills you need, which is a lot, and a lot more, I think, than people were expecting to find, because it turns out it's really complicated.
Not enough time to list 53, but is there anything in that list of 53 that someone would find surprising?
How important it is to have a bullshit detector and be able to critically evaluate the stuff that you see is really, really important. And it's a lot harder now, honestly, than it used to be. 10 years ago, if someone emailed you saying that they were, a Nigerian prince and they have a lot of money for you, you could, okay, well, probably that's not true. But today it's more complicated, especially for people who aren't familiar with the internet, because they go online and they see the Pope, and they see Donald Trump, and they see actual princes and actual billionaires. People tweeted Elon Musk, and are like, hey, can you help me with this project? He's like, sure, I'll donate to your project, or then he'll start, insulting people on the internet. So if you get an email from someone saying, hey, I'm a billionaire, I need help with a thing, that's not crazy. It's not a crazy idea.
Because it happens.
So a lot of things that we kind of take for granted, having watched the internet evolve, when people are new to it and they come online for the first time, even, very, very smart people, very educated people who just aren't familiar with what the culture of the internet looks like, it's tough to know how to tell if something is real and how to critically evaluate what that looks like. I mean, it's tough here, too. Just look at fake news.
Oh, yeah. And even not even like fake news that's confusing. Like, think about like 15 years ago where you went to the supermarket and you saw like there was some newspaper and a hunter holding up like a 6-foot-long cricket or something.
Yeah, it's like Bat Boy.
Yeah. And back then you're like, that's totally fake.
Yeah.
Nowadays, if you saw an image of a hunter on the internet holding up a giant cricket, like, it's
that's
not
a good hunter, yeah.
It's not the realm of possibility that, you know what, maybe there's a giant cricket somewhere.
Yeah.
Like, it's odd how the way you consume the fakeness has changed, like, whether you believe it or not.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's not that much difference between a hunter holding up fake crickets and looking at those videos of coconut crabs.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
huge.
Those look fake. Those are Jim Henson creations, from the Dark Crystal that we didn't know about. And if you don't know how to evaluate, you know, especially explicitly Western media, which is, you know, most media that you see in English, if you don't know how to evaluate those things, then you kind of have to trust your sources, and your sources are not necessarily trustworthy.
And also probably the further back you go, it was easier to separate what would be entertainment from pure journalistic intent. Whereas now they've kind of merged together where, like, you don't necessarily know if what you're looking at is fact or opinion or the motives, whether it's to report or influence.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that the blending of those lines, I mean, that's a tough problem. It's a really tough problem.
Okay, so back to the overall concept of internet health.
Yeah.
Is this like a metric that you could kind of see how things change over time, or is it more sort of like the nuclear doomsday clock where you're kind of saying, like, this just happened
and now we're 2 minutes to midnight?
Yeah.
It's a little of both, honestly. I think that if you look at a lot of the kind of work that was done on the environmental movement in the 60s and 70s, people were like, oh, you know, there's a hole in the ozone layer, it's a disaster, species are going extinct, it's a disaster. And there were all of these individual things that people were trying to work on. And then at some point, it kind of coalesced into an environmental movement where people started talking about it. Oh, the problem isn't the whales or the forest, it's that all of these things are part of a system, and the system can only withstand so much stress in one place or another. And we need to tackle it as a kind of holistic issue. And I think that we're seeing something very, very similar appearing with the internet, where the problem isn't encryption, and the problem isn't fake news, and it's not the digital divide. It's when you put all of these things together, systems emerge that can be exploited for profit or for political motives, people fall through the cracks, and the environment of the internet that we live in and are surrounded by has so many components of it that we have to look at it as part of a larger system. Otherwise, it's really not going to be possible to effectively mobilize to fix it.
So I understand what you're saying here about the system, but it's very easy for me to say save the pandas because they're cute and they're fuzzy, or save the whales, or save the box turtle, or there's a hole in the ozone layer.
Yeah.
It's very difficult for me to say that, like, hey, everyone, like, everyone needs to make a lifestyle change, or the system is going to get weirder and weirder, and it's not just about the whales, it's about everything.
Yeah.
So in regards to the internet, like, how do you say we need to save, or what do you do to say we have to save the system,
right,
without focusing on an individual part and missing the bigger picture?
Well, I think that you need to focus on those individual parts because the pandas and the whales do need to be saved. I think the trick is making sure that the framing of it isn't the problem is the only problem we have is the pandas, or not showing the place of the pandas in the ecosystem. Right? It's like, well, if the pandas are gone, they don't eat the bamboo, and that means there are more crickets or whatever it is. Being able to put those problems in context, right? Like, what does it mean, like trolling, right? Like,
sure.
Like, what does it mean when, if you go online and you are of, you know, you're a minority or you're a woman, and if you have an unpopular opinion, you get chased off the internet? What does that mean for the internet? Well, it means that there are fewer voices on the internet. It means that a lot of people who otherwise maybe would have taken advantage of career opportunities available through the internet, you know, they've just checked out of the internet as a safety issue. That impacts the digital divide. That impacts skills for people who are going to be coming on the internet next. Lack of encryption or lack of easy encryption, lack of the understanding of how to use encryption or two-factor authentication or something like that makes those things easier to accomplish, makes it easier to harass people. So it isn't any of those one things in isolation. It's the fact that there are so many of these individual issues that we need to deal with. We need to recognize that they do all impact each other, and that while we can focus on them individually, the problem is bigger than any of them, and we need to recognize that these things are linked, and that someone who is working on harassment does need to care about IPv6 deployment, and someone working on IPv6 deployment does need to care about web literacy, because there's so much going on that you can't be siloed in the same kind of way. Mm-hmm. So part of the whole idea behind the Internet Health Report is to try and start or contribute to or facilitate a conversation around the larger issues, so that we can kind of look at all of these individual data points and look at maybe how they fit together.
Now, like ideal utopia internet.
Utopia internet.
Yeah, the utopia internet.
Sounds
the,
nice.
Like the perfect earth,
yeah,
where unlimited renewable energy, food for everyone, like Star Trek.
Amazing, Star Trek, yeah.
So I mean, what are some aspects of a perfectly healthy internet system, and how do we move towards that goal?
I think that some elements are the same as we strive towards now. Permissionless innovation, someone being able to have an idea, write software, build a website, start a business, start a collective without having to sign off, have someone else sign off on it, right? Like if Facebook was the internet tomorrow, Facebook can shut down your Facebook app if they don't like it. But it's much harder to shut down someone who has just built a website or someone who's, you know, helped define a new protocol. So that ability to innovate in a way that allows for innovation and does not require permission from other people or other gatekeepers, I think is a really, really important piece. Being able to use the internet in a way that is not that is safe, and by that I mean is not damaging to your home security, to your pocketbook, to your mental health, to the privacy of your kids, to any of those things. Being able to communicate freely and say things that if other people don't like it, don't result in you getting swatted and, you know, the cops kicking down your door and maybe shooting your dog and maybe shooting you. The ability to have meaningful access for people. The internet exists in a lot of places, but in a lot of places what that access looks like is totally, totally different. And that might be a censorship thing, like in China the websites people can access behind the Great Firewall are different than outside. But it's also a bandwidth thing in some places. It's a device thing in some places. You can have access to the internet in rural Kenya, but probably it's through mobile. Probably you don't have a high bandwidth connection. So you're not using Netflix, right? Like you're not using a lot of internet sites that are available to everyone else that are part of kind of the, you know, the larger cultural lexicon. So being able to access the same things for everyone, everywhere, would be a big part of it.
Mm-hmm. So now some of these, like a lot of these challenges seem like, you know, technological. A lot of them also seem cultural.
Absolutely, yeah.
So the cultural ones, other than like saying, hey everyone, be excellent to each other.
Right.
Like, are there like technological processes, like how do you make everyone be kind, but limit censorship?
Right.
How do you remove barriers to entry, but stop like an abuse of basically a free resource?
Right, yeah, it's super tough. There is a lot of interesting work that's being done actually using sites like Reddit as research kind of experiments, because a lot of the Reddit data set is public, and some researchers have worked directly with specific subreddits. There's I don't remember the researcher's name, but they're mentioned in the report. They worked with the Ask Science subreddit, mm-hmm, to look at, okay, if we put the code of conduct or the rules in different places, does that cut down on spamming? Does it cut down on comments that are going to get downvoted? Can we, by making tweaks, change the way people respond to it? And so there's a lot of interesting research done there. Some people are trying to use machine learning to figure out in advance if comments are likely to be trolls or not. And if they are troll comments, maybe there's an additional barrier to entry to participate in that forum. Maybe that's you have to answer a multiple choice quiz about the article that was just posted just to show that you read it and you're not, yeah, just on there, you know, shit posting. I think that a big part of it is understanding that the internet was built on, you know, culturally built on libertarian notions of freedom and free speech, and it worked really well for a really long time. But it's big enough now that those same principles which allowed the free exchange of ideas and free speech are now being used to shut down and silence speech from other people. And that without explicit recognition of how different the experience of the internet could be for someone who is a minority or suffers oppression otherwise. All internet connections are not equal, and all people's experiences are not equal, and we need to figure out a way that we can build systems that accommodates for those different experiences.
Mm-hmm. Something that I find interesting, I recall reading something a while back how most people, and it becomes like self-selecting, how you end up putting yourself into your own like echo chamber.
Right.
And the internet's very good at reinforcing whatever your beliefs are, because yep. Google knows what search results to give you, and Facebook knows what to post on your wall that you're likely to click.
Yeah.
So, like, very rarely do you hear consenting voices.
Yeah.
So, like, is that the... But that echo chamber is self-selecting, like, I like NPR, and I like these things, so I'm going to continue to hear those things.
Right.
If someone's echo chamber, now I'm not saying that my truth is any better than anyone else's truth, but if someone else's echo chamber is negative and filled with fake news,
right.
they caused it on themselves, and it's the content that they're consuming.
Right.
So, like, is that like an education thing? Is that like...
I think there's a couple of factors. I think one of the things is that if you look at something like Facebook, where, you know, the business model of Facebook is getting you to click on things, right? Like, so Facebook will collect as much information about you as it can in order to get you to click on ads, because they sell the ads and that's how they make money. So Facebook will work to show you things that it thinks you will click on, which are not necessarily informed by your choices in the same kind of way as what newspapers you're buying. There was some research done on conspiracy websites on the internet, and the way that through kind of the automatic machine learning that Google and Facebook do, how they're kind of inadvertently cross-pollinating different conspiracy groups. So there was a researcher who was doing work on anti-vaccine groups and trying to understand, why do anti-vaccine groups trust, you know, these sources but not these sources. And one thing they found is that when you participate heavily in anti-vaccine groups on the internet, the suggested groups or the next, the auto roll from YouTube will be things like Pizzagate. It'll be things like Hillary's emails or whatever. And by creating those associations, a lot of websites are kind of doing work to insulate people further and further from the truth without intending to, but it's not just the media that you choose echo chamber, it's also the way that these systems are built for engagement have led to a lot of unintended consequences that do in any direction further compartmentalize and or radicalize people based on what could be a pretty innocuous starting point.
Yeah, I've never really thought about that. It only takes like a small, like, on little kids love watching videos of other kids playing with toys, let's say.
Yeah.
So, like, you go to YouTube, it's YouTube, music videos, whatever,
yep.
You search for toys. Before you know it, everything you're seeing in the sidebar are different people in different parts of the world playing with toys.
Yeah.
Till all you're seeing is people playing with toys.
Absolutely.
You might not know that animals exist anymore.
Right, yeah.
And it is a business function that the businesses are causing the dysfunction.
Yeah.
As a feature of their business, I guess.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where people just either didn't think about it or honestly couldn't conceive of where we would end up.
Yeah.
You know, I think that the ability of something like YouTube having an autoplay role, someone was just like, oh, wouldn't it be a cool idea if we have related videos? That would be great. We'll just, you know, show whatever the most popular videos are for this thing. But if there are kind of relationships between topics that are not based in, you know, fact or any kind of offline thing, but are just based in associations between users, and some users who watch these videos like, these stories about vaccines, some of them like these stories about how jet fuel can't melt steel beams, then maybe we should show these truther videos to the people who like this.
Basically teach, like, both sides?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that works for let's say things that are leaning towards the right end of things.
Right.
Would you do the same thing for things that are, if someone only looks at things that are factual, like
right.
I'm looking at, I don't know, watching lots of animal videos about evolution, would you start showing videos about intelligent design?
I mean, I think that companies like Facebook and Google that and Twitter that spend so much time on figuring out what content do we show to people, I think that they have a responsibility to make sure that those algorithms are built in a way that are transparent, that they can be audited, and that they can be evaluated to not be making the world worse.
It's in a similar way of like, I don't like smoking or taxing soda. If you know what you're doing is causing harm, you should do things to mitigate it.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that for a long time companies didn't think about it, and now I think a lot of companies are very actively trying hard not to think about it, because if they think about it, then what kind of liability issues does that open them up to, right? Mm-hmm. Internet companies have largely operated under the premise and usually under the legal framework that they're not responsible for the content that goes over there.
It's like a safe haven thing?
Safe haven or common carrier.
Common carrier.
And that's great. We want those things. We don't want, you know, someone to, you know, we don't want Twitter to go out of business because one person posted something on it that was, you know, libelous and they get sued. But by divorcing themselves so seriously from the content of their networks, they also failed to create any thinking around what is their responsibility to the safety of their users. And people might think about it in terms of, you'll see in more recent video game consoles, for example, is it easier or harder for people to examine the traffic that's going on and kick other people off their, you know, network so you can win a Counter-Strike. You know, at some point Xbox Live thought, okay, well we have to, this is a problem, we have to fix how easy this is for people to do. But I don't think companies like Twitter and Facebook and whoever else have really put the thought into, if someone joins Twitter or someone is watching YouTube videos, is our site built in a way that takes into account what they might be vulnerable to? And that might be technical. It might be technical attacks. It might be not setting an option to have your email address be public so people don't know that, you know, their email address or their phone number is searchable. Or it might be looking at, well, if someone is watching a lot of kids' videos, then maybe the videos that they see up next should all be whitelisted and someone should have looked at it and made sure that it's all appropriate for kids first. So I think it's really about thinking differently about what is the responsibility of a company that is so important to the media that we're all consuming and to the relationships that we all have.
Now, this seems like a really overwhelming, that like there's so many angles and so many things. I would assume like this is just a battle of inches as time goes on. In what ways do you feel like the health has gained ground and lost ground in recently?
I think that in some areas like access, encryption, we've definitely gained ground. Encryption is becoming easier to use. We're getting a better understanding of the types of encryption that are strong or not. The Snowden revelations really kind of brought into focus how good enough security is usually not good enough. And access is becoming a lot cheaper. Access is being delivered to more places. The ability of the internet to transform lives from someone, you know, who lives in an inner city trying to access government services to, you know, like a camel farmer in Somalia, being able to participate in kind of a global marketplace. All those things are amazing. GDPR in the EU putting out very, very strong rules for the way data should be handled that multinationals really are going to be forced to reckon with. All of that is really, really great. And those are definitely wins. But when we look at who is online, the treatment of people online, the security of people online, and how hard it is for a lot of people to participate in that global economy, it's worse. Internet shutdowns are growing year after year. Governments are increasingly cutting off internet access to...
Was that Turkey recently? Where
There were definitely
incidents
in Turkey.
It was like an election day where they just turned off the internet.
Yeah, there were similar incidents in Cameroon. There was something around the Caledonian referendum that was similar. And a lot of these are legal because the laws in those countries say, well, we're allowed to do this. So it's not a question in some places of legal shutdowns. It's just the government has decided it's a good idea and okay to do that. Afghanistan tried shutting down Telegram and WhatsApp for a while. And to most people, I shouldn't say most people, but for a lot of people in Afghanistan, Telegram is the internet and WhatsApp is the messenger. And that's what they use. So when you cut those things off, you are cutting people off from their families, from their social communities, from everything. It's not like if WhatsApp were shut off here, or I have you on Messenger instead, or just SMS you. So the centralization of these services and the lack of backups, or the prevalence of single points of failure, make it a lot easier for governments to use the internet to oppress. So in a lot of places like that, it is getting worse, and we are seeing those tools deployed by governments more and more often.
So I wasn't aware that like Mozilla did this.
Right.
Like I had no idea that, I thought it was a browser and that was that.
Right.
If people want to get more information on this, like more information on how they can get involved in terms of like where to go or what advocacy they could do, where do you start?
So I work for the part of Mozilla that's called the Mozilla Foundation. It's the nonprofit and it owns the Mozilla Corporation, right? So it's the parent of Mozilla Corp, which makes Firefox and Pocket and everything else. And the Mozilla Foundation tries to take the resources that we have and leverage them to make the web better and make the internet better. So for example, we have fellowship programs where people who are doing interesting research can apply, and we'll sponsor them as fellows for a year just to do the work that they're doing so they can do it in a way that's funded. We also have, I think this month we're closing applications this month, but we're giving away about $250,000 to artists who are making art about the way AI could impact us in the future. So the Mozilla Foundation does a lot of work, including the Internet Health Report, that is not necessarily technical. It's not product-oriented, but it's to try and get people together and uplift the work that people are doing to make the internet better. So you can go to foundation.mozilla.org. You can Google Internet Health Report or go to internethealthreport.org to look at some of the other work that the Mozilla Foundation is doing.
Okay, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate the time.
Awesome, thank you for having me.
Yeah, it was great having you. Great conversation.
Thank you.